CoinWorld Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about CoinWorld Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.
Welcome to the CoinWorld Podcast with your host, Jeff Stark.
And as I've said from day one of this show, this is a big tent hobby. There's a lot of room for folks.
And Larry Jewett.
And learning has been such a tremendous amount of this journey.
The CoinWorld Podcast.
Welcome to the CoinWorld Podcast. It's another episode on its way here today with a very special guest. I'm Larry Jewett.
And I'm Jeff Stark. And we got to speak with Nicholas Brie, the author of a new book about U.S. Treasury notes. You'll get to learn all about them just in a bit, as Larry and I did. What an interesting, fascinating fiscal history that these pieces provide to, they really are a window to the financial history of the early republic. So that's coming up in just a bit. But boy, are we teed up to have fun even before then. Right, boss?
Oh, yeah, definitely so. And, you know, the nice thing about being able to record the podcast for me here lately is it means that I'm not spending my time. I'm spending my time doing something more productive for the big picture than I am buying coins on online auctions that I don't need because I get caught up in buying fever. I end up, you know, just saying, well, I think we can buy that. I think I should buy that. And then somebody drives the price up, and then all of a sudden I don't want to lose. And next thing I know, I'm buying something I already have two of. So, I mean, let me be a lesson to everybody out there that if you're going to be doing this, do it the right way. I mean, I listened to a presentation by Colonel Steve Howard in the Fun Show in January, and it talked about having a plan. Well, I'll tell you one thing. Some of these online auctions have just undermined my plan completely, because that comes down to the plan just seems like lately is I got to have it. And I'm talking about casino tokens that, you know, I don't even know the casinos I've never been to. But just the idea that somebody wanted it, so then I decided I wanted it even better. I think there's hope for me, because this is now no longer spending the money on online, you know, bingo games or anything like that. So, you know, hi, my name is Larry. I have a problem. I'm buying too many coins. I don't think anybody's ever said that, have they?
Numismatics Anonymous. I've heard of NA, but that's
And there was an NA token that, you know, I could have purchased, and I didn't, because it was a wrong NA is what it comes down to.
So, well, you know, I definitely am thinking about that as well lately, as I'm, you know, maybe over the next year embarking on a house shopping and all that, trying to, oh my gosh, I got to move all this stuff. Why do I have all this stuff? How can I get rid of this stuff? I shouldn't have bought this stuff. All those things. Some of the stuff that I have is provides immense joy. So that is the exception, perhaps. But definitely coming up with a plan is wise. And, you know, even if the plan is, well, I'm going to get whatever I want, but it's within this range, you know, no more than X amount per month or whatever. But it's I tell you, it's tough. I mean, I was at a ball game last night, and I went to the elongated cent machine, and I made a couple sets. It's like, why do I need two sets of these? Well, you know, they're only 51 cents a coin, and it's, you know, I took 1964 dated Lincoln cents there, because, you know, if you're into elongates, you know that you want to use any pre-82 cent because of the zinc plating. It just, a lot of folks think it looks less appealing when you roll it out in an elongate. So local coin shop for $1 a roll, I got 1964 dated cents. Perfect. This is what I'm going to use for my elongates. But then I made a couple sets, and I go, what do I do with the extras? So, but it was fun. you know, and that is what this is all about after all.
Well, when you talk about the elongates, I know Paul Jokes just had a story about the grading services, and they're deciding on which elongates they're going to grade. And I sit there and I think about this. Does that mean that the coin that was used as an elongate was that grade before? I just, you know, it's just like that's going down a rabbit hole on something like that.
Well, there are, especially when you're talking about countermark stuff, they, you know, talk about what's the grade of the host coin, what's the grade of the application or change, you know, afterwards. So I think in the case of elongates from the modern grading services, that's what kind of wear is evidenced on the piece as, I won't say damaged, but as modified, right?
Right.
That's my understanding, because, you know, a lot of elongates, especially you go back to the early era of elongate since 1893 Columbian Exposition, 1904 St. Louis World's Fair, you know, they were used as commemoratives, as souvenirs. People might have carried them around as pocket pieces. They did get worn, and that's what you're referring to. Thankfully, my new St. Louis Cardinals set of four, they're all uncirculated, and I put them in plastic flips at the stadium, came home, put them in plastic 2x2s, and now they're not going to be damaged in pocket wear and all that, you know, from pocket wear and all that. So it's, you know, it's elongated sense. That's just another cheap way to have fun with numismatics that doesn't involve the big ticket stuff. And I will say some big ticket stuff caught my eye this week. And I kind of just kind of shake my head and go, what would I, if I had had that kind of money, what would I have bought instead of this? Make of the story, making the rounds, grading service in an auction house, collaborated to sell certified examples of Royal Mint coins. So I guess, in a sense, the Royal Mint also played in on this, or was involved on this as well. And we love the Royal Mint and have had them on. And I know Larry's bought his Greyhound coin from them and all that. But yep. I just kind of wondered, they sold the very last coins of Queen Elizabeth II and the very first coins with the King Charles III portrait. And some of these pieces established or realized jaw-dropping numbers. The piece de la Résistance, the biggest item, was the very last 2022 gold sovereign with the Queen's portrait, which was graded MS70 DPL, realized $42,000. And, you know, okay, yeah, I don't have that kind of dough, but maybe if I sold all my collection together, and you know, I've got way too much stuff, sure, maybe if I got rid of all that, I could get one marquee piece like that. But would I get that piece? I don't think so. I think if I were going to get one marquee piece, I would want something like an auto dollar from China or an ancient gold, you know, fill in the blank of Alexander the Great, or, you know, there's so many other options that you could chase down. But I'm also not somebody who wants to yuck another person's yum. I'm not going to say that's not valid or that's not right. Somebody can, you know, afford to go collect something and they go get it, then more power to them. I love it. You collect however you want to and how you decide. And I wonder, am I missing the boat here? Is this going to be the same sort of thing that, you know, 100 years from now? I mean, I think about some of the, like the Scott, maybe the Scott replicas of the counter of the Confederate coins, J.W. Scott restrikes. When those were made, did somebody have that same sort of maybe dismissive attitude? Well, now they're avidly collected. They're part of the hobby. There's that you don't encounter resistance to them like the sort of resistance I'm throwing up at this other stuff. And I go, does time heal all wounds? Is that the thing that makes the object worthy of collecting just because time has elapsed? I don't think that's the case. I think maybe a more open opinion, maybe I need to bring that wider open opinion to the table. But I just wondered, that to me was I saw a lot of coverage of this and I thought, man, I love the idea. Okay, it's the first and the last and you can go collect this stuff. But I even had a guy in Ohio who's no slouch when it comes to being able to buy what he wants. He talked to me over the weekend and had seen it and was marveling at it. And I just thought, man, that's a lot of people are talking about it. So this is where I come at it. But I'm willing to say that I certainly don't have the answers and don't have the correct opinion. It's just an opinion. Everyone has one. There you go. That's my opinion.
Yeah, that's and definitely it. And I mean, I see this as a kind of thing that looking upon this, I've always marveled at the fact that there are so many possible ways of being collected. And when you have somebody whose interest is so high in something that you can't understand, God love them. They don't understand what you're doing either. There are things that my wife collects that I wouldn't collect, though it seems like I end up collecting them for her. And there are some things that, when you start out, you have this one type of collection, then you move on to something different before you complete it, that type of thing. If somebody is interested in the type of thing you were describing right there and you're not, that's one person who's not going to be competing with you eventually for something that you want really bad or need to complete a set or whatever the case may be. And these individuals are not part of it. They're off doing their own thing and they don't have to worry about you either. So it's just, and that's why we have clubs that are specifically like Liberty Seated and like Barber Club, people like that, that have shared interests. They don't have any interest in, for the most part, for any of the other stuff. I mean, it's great that, let them do their thing. And when something comes up that's in that realm, then, have at it. But, price-wise, it just comes down to what's been said that, one man's junk is another man's treasure from earlier what we were talking about. But in this case, we're not talking junk here. We're talking about a case where if you put two bidders in the same area and they both have the same motivation, then price is going to go up. We've seen that. But I mean, and that doesn't have to be anything that's a headline piece. That could be anything. I mean, I experienced that on the online stuff when it's $1, $2, $3, $4. Is it worth it? $4 versus, several hundred thousand? In the grand scheme of things, no, but the same motivation is all right there as well. So it's an answer. It's a question without an answer. It's one of those whys when the answer is why not. So
I will take that as a good final word on topic. I do think it's wise though. It just in the whole discussion of what we're doing, and we talk about have a plan and all that. It's something to consider as you think about your plan. And
but that plan could change tomorrow. That's the thing.
For sure. I don't want to look at tomorrow though. I want to look backward. spend time looking back at history. And so I think it's that's maybe a clumsy segue, but I want to go back in time and look at this week in numismatic history. And kind of a big deal in the scheme of things from a bullion standpoint. What was happening on September 5th? Well, you go to 1979, a year that's near and dear to my heart. That was when Canada put its first Maple Leaf gold bullion coins on sale. And Canada really was the vanguard, the leader, if you will, after the Krugerrand debuted in 1967. You had Canada's Maple Leaf follow 12 years later and quickly gained strong market share. You have the whole South African apartheid undercurrent in the 1980s that really affected the market for the Krugerrand. So Canada was able to dominate the bullion space. Another reason they were able to dominate was because they were the first to do 3/9 fine and then 4/9 fine. I want to say 4/9 fine came in 1982, but I'd have to go look at my bullion Bible from my good friend Sebastian Wachowski, and that's in the other room. But I thought, hey, that's, you know, bullion is such an important driver of the market today, and that eventually that would pave the way for the American program, which is, of course, the big dog on the porch. Canada is a strong, I would say, second, but hard to outpace the U.S. bullion program. But September 5, 1979, that's when the Maple Leaf gold bullion coin went on sale. So that is your This Week in Numismatic History.
I'm loving it. Good concept right there. Beautiful. Just keeping an eye on those metals. I mean, gold back up again and silver.
Silver's up. I'm not paying attention to
big
gold.
Time. Yeah, gold's back up over the 19 mark. But I mean, you know, silver pushing at 25 right now. So awesome.
Yes. I'm loving that. You know, it makes buying harder, but it takes what you have and imbues more value to it. So I will say we've looked back in numismatic history. Now I want to look back in coin world history. And the item that I highlight from the September 3rd, 2018 issue is something that has much more value symbolically than any sort of precious metal component. We went with 2018 because that year was a big year in the evolution of collector Nick Brouillé, who you'll hear from in just a bit in the U.S. Treasury Notes book. But it was nice to look back, now coming up on 5 years for this issue. And I saw a story that I vaguely remembered. It's about a Czech artist, Otakar Dusek, who I've had the privilege of meeting 16 years ago now in 2007 at the FIDEM conference in Colorado Springs. And we did a story about him and his work in the publication, short-lived publication, 3 years or so, Worldwide Coins, published by Amos. Anyway, Otakar created a medal to memorialize the lives lost in the Todesmarsch or Death March. And this medal was awarded the inaugural or newly established at the time Melwax Judaica Art Medal Award. And it was presented at the 2018 FIDEM conference. That's French words, Fédération Internationale de la Médaille Art. It's Art Congress. Anyway, the medal that Otakar created it looks very plain. It looks almost like a silver bar, and it just has some words on it that recount three cities and gives the name of the march and the dates of the march. This happened in 1945. April 13th to June 6th, and a bunch of people were marched from Helmbrex, which sounds like it might be a Dutch location, to Zwolle in, I believe, what was the Czech Republic, then to another place, Volary. In any event, the medal, he actually wore these medals on the underside of his shoe and walked that journey, that path that 1,200 women prisoners from this death camp marched 75 years earlier, whatever it was. Yeah, 70 years after the death, after the death march, he set out. He made 70 of these medals with wore boots with special soles into which he inserted the silver medals. And, you know, it almost became numismatic performance art. But, you know, the story of the medals, I think, was just so touching, so moving. And I'm glad we were able to tell that story in that issue. For anybody who is a CoinWorld subscriber, you can access the archives, which go back to 2018 and earlier. So you can listen, you can read this this article and learn about this topic. It's just a neat medal that whose meaning is far more than what you can discern at first glance. So that's what jumped out to me out of the issue. It still to this day, I don't know if you can hear, but it still moves me to hear about this this march and the very little known event in history, and then also to be able to memorialize it with this modern medallic art concept.
Well, there are no letters for me to draw upon, but in that September 3rd, 2018 issue, there's a story that you had written that really appealed to me, and that was in the paper money section called Circus Comes to Town on Paper Collectibles. Now, it hits close to home because the first paragraph talks about the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus folding in 2017. And at the time, that's where I was employed. I was actually working for Feld Entertainment in Ellenton, Florida at the time of that. So that one hit close to home. And looking through there and seeing about Baraboo and looking at all the different notes that you were talking about just reminded me that the Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus will be returning at the end of September. It's just going to be without animals. I mean, animals were part of this story here. The tiger, the lions, that type of thing, but no animals in the circus. And you can go ahead and mark on your calendar, they're coming to St. Louis in December. But, you know, just the idea that the circus was such an inspiration for a lot of youth all the way through there, going back 140 plus years before Feld Entertainment bought the company in 1967 and then 50 years into its existence. Because of pressures and politics and that type of thing, had to redirect. And now we're going to see a reimagined circus coming back there. But I don't know that there's going to be any script connection to it like it was back in the day that you talked about in this story. But I think it's a very good story that the part of it that I've read so far. As a matter of fact, in addition to circus, one of my favorite memories as a young parent was taking my children to Circus World over on the intersection US 27 and I-4. Paul Jilk's very familiar with that area because he covered that for the Winter Haven News Chief. That was his beat over there as well. But some great stories about circus collectibles. And now we talked earlier about how many things. And So if a circus collectible comes up in an auction, there's a good chance I'm going to be bidding on it.
Oh, goodness. Yeah. Again, define your parameters. But yeah. Anyway.
I want it. My parameters are I want it. Okay.
Hey, as long as you can swing it, and yeah, by all means. I am, like I say, it is like, what do I do with all this? How do I organize this? Why do I have this? But you can put those collection of collections. I know a friend here in St. Louis has a collection of collections and has meticulously organized them. And I'm jealous of a lot of things that he has, but also the fact that he's been able to and has the space to store them in such a easy to understand and access manner. So anyway, very good. Well, thanks for the shout out for me. I wasn't counting on that, but hey, it is what it is. Hopefully I can give you a shout out here if you can answer last week's trivia question. I wanted to highlight how there's just so many so many ways to collect and things to collect. And since we talked to the fine folks at Richmond Coin Club, Coin and Currency Club, Richmond, Indiana, I wanted to know how many different classifications, categories of numismatic objects one could collect from Richmond, Indiana. And I actually did some digging. I had one category on here and I searched for them and couldn't find any, so I've crossed it off. There's some others that are, I think, speculative, but there really is no wrong answer. There's just more right answers, if you will. What are some of the classifications that you can think of numismatic objects that can be collected from, in all honesty, most any average town of, you know, 50,000 or 20,000 or whatever, and specifically Richmond, Indiana?
Well, I think about, you know, the fact that there is a lot of history there, and there probably were merchant tokens at the very least that were around somehow, and maybe even commemorative tokens of special events like festivals or centennials or that type of thing. I mean, more obviously, we're not talking about things that the U.S. Mint would have necessarily put out, but we're talking about ways that we could have commemorated things locally. I mean, there could have been some script type things that came out there, but that, those are some of the things that come to mind right off the bat there. And
sure.
I'm sure there are a few more, but.
So you mentioned something not coming from the Mint, and that's right, but you overlooked the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. And so I would say that there are national banknotes.
Yeah, probably. I think Wendell can tell us that one. So.
Yeah, and Civil War tokens, I believe, from there. Transit tokens.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned script, which is a broad and encompassing category that, you know, so obsoletes I've got down there, but I also, and that could include advertising notes, depression script, a specific type of script. So I'm counting that in with the script. Also, you mentioned trade tokens, merchant tokens, very good. I thought elongates might exist from there. I could not find any reference. So, you know, maybe there are, and I just don't know about them. Encased sense, Earl Fankhauser was a famous Indiana, I guess, hobbyist and businessman who helped create encased sense for a lot of companies all over, especially the Midwest. And I believe there are some encased sense available for Richmond, Indiana. So that is just like, I won't say the tip of the iceberg. That's a big chunk, but there's probably a couple things we're not even thinking of that, you know, somebody's going to send us an email and say, what about fill in the blank? Yeah. We're going to go, duh.
Earlham College is there. So there could have been college currency as well. So.
You got it.
Yeah.
You got it. I have college currency written, question mark written down on my piece of paper. So very good. This was, again, there's kind of like Whose Line? The points are made up and, you know.
Whose Line is it anyway? Yeah.
It's made up and the points don't matter or whatever, but you did good. You did good. You got a couple that you overlooked, but hey, now you have another shot. We'll give you and the listeners time to think about this as you're listening to the interview with Nicholas Brouillé, all about treasury notes, U.S. treasury notes. New book came out, just published by Stax Bowers. And I wanted to know, I actually went and looked in the book. So not from the Coin World Trivia Game, it's in the book. What is the highest denomination treasury note issued? And how often, how many times, you know, because there were several, as you'll learn in the interview, there were several series of releases. How many times did they issue a note of this denomination? I don't think we talk about it in the interview, but you're just going to have to listen and find out for sure. And definitely you can be sure if you pick up a copy of the book. You'll hear all about it coming up right now. The Coin World Podcast is delighted today to be joined by Nicholas Brouillé, who is the author of a newly published book, U.S. Treasury Notes, 1812 to 1865 in Illustrated History. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you, Jeff. It's a pleasure to be here.
Hey, and it's a pleasure to pick up this book because I should say I was able to get a copy of this at the ANA a couple weeks ago in Pittsburgh. This book is published under the auspices of Stax Bowers, and it's, as best I can tell, the first and only real substantive look at this area of paper money history. Is that right?
I think it's the first time that it's all been brought together as a comprehensive chronology. So it covers the entire period from really after the Constitutional Convention and Hamilton becoming Secretary of the Treasury in 1791 on through the end of the Civil War.
And for somebody who's not aware, first off, is it safe to call the official, the Treasury notes that, I mean, because you do, like you say, you talk about the history of the young republic there from right after founding, but there's 20 some years in there before the 1812 issue of the first notes. Are these Treasury notes, can we call them the first official paper money of the U.S.?
Well, we can certainly, in fact, call them that because of the usage. They were pressed into service. They were the original notes as first issues were interest bearing and were generally regarded as what they call bills of credit, which is something normally that you would earn interest from the government and you would redeem for its face value plus an interest amount. But what we find in reality is that they became the de facto paper money of the country for this 60-year period and were used for all kinds of things everywhere from buying warships to paying congressmen's salaries.
And according to Peter Treglia of Stax, this book is a coherent and chronologically ordered book on early U.S. paper money. My thought is it contextualizes the issues of the various notes, why they were issued and how they served the economy of a fledgling nation and more. There was a great quote in the introduction, at the nation's most desperate moments when federal depositories were emptied, when mountains of creditor bills piled up for months, when armies in the field went unpaid, when fearful bankers refused to loan the government a dime, time and again, Congress and the Treasury Department turned to Treasury notes to rescue their administrations from insolvency. What a mouthful. What more can be said, though? That sounds like these are some of the most important U.S. Paper money issues, and I think that they may have been overlooked in collector hands, but there's good reason for that, right?
Yeah, I think that the quote you just read really speaks to the issue that these notes came out in, for the most part, during dire circumstances. When the country was waging war, such as the War of 1812 or the Mexican War in 1846, or, of course, the Civil War. And the Treasury notes played a huge part in the Civil War. Many collectors don't understand or don't realize that the demand notes that were issued in 1861 are in fact non-interest bearing treasury notes. And there's a long history of the government issuing treasury notes that didn't bear interest. And the reason for that was because they wanted them to circulate as money, not be held as you would with a bond as an interest bearing item.
I want to go back just a little bit here because we talked earlier, Jeff mentioned about how this seems to have filled a void, so to speak. Was there any event in your collecting experience that led you to write this book?
I would say the starting point was the auction of the fantastic Joel Anderson paper money collection in 2018. There were just a huge number of spectacular and rare notes. And one of those, as I went through the catalog and were looking at possible things to bid on, was an 1861 $50 treasury note. And I was trying to learn about it. there wasn't much information about it in the standard reference books. So I started digging. One of the things I used to try to find out about the note was that the payee written on the front of the note was a fellow by the name of James Brunow, who I learned was a lieutenant in an Iowa volunteer regiment. And that had me scratching my head. Why was a soldier becoming a payee for a treasury note in 1861 in the months when the war had just started? And that took me down a road that led to learning about how the treasury notes were so often used as money, because he was the quartermaster for an Iowa volunteer regiment. And the Treasury Department was paying him in these treasury notes so that he could buy supplies for his regiment and food for his regiment.
And that aha moment, as you described it, set you out on this journey. How quickly did you discover the history of these? And my understanding, a lot of these are unique or nearly so. How do you approach a topic like that when there's so little, so few objects to collect and so little known about them?
I think that was one of the real challenges. There's so few notes known that collectors haven't paid much attention to them. And also the history can seem like just a mind-numbing jungle when you take a look, for example, at the treasury notes issued during the Civil War. I was looking at these notes, and there's 5% notes and 6% notes and coupon-bearing notes and non-coupon-bearing notes. And frankly, it was incredibly confusing to me. And I just made a decision to try to sort this all out and put it in some kind of order that made sense. Why was the government issuing these things? When were they issuing them? And for how long? And, answer these basic questions. And that took me down the road to putting together a real chronology, which became this history. Because they were issued really entirely in dire circumstances, gave me an opportunity to learn the history of some of the great events in the first half century of our country.
And so many of the chapters of this book, I mean, toward the end, you have just a breakdown of all the different types and the series, if you will, of issues, the reasons for the issue, whether that was the various wars or panics in 37 and 57. But this is really functioning in my mind as almost an economic textbook for American history.
I think people who don't even really have much of an interest in paper money will enjoy reading this, because it does, by necessity, provide a deep understanding of what was going on with the country in these moments and what was happening with the United States Treasury Department when they were trying to pay for these things. And, they repeatedly found themselves in extremely difficult circumstances. Of course, the biggest of all of that was the Civil War. And there's a great interest in paper money of the Civil War, and more opportunities to collect that, because hundreds of millions of dollars of paper money issued back then. So there are survivors that people can collect. In other cases, you have things like the Panic of 1837, where there's just one single issued note that survives in collectors' hands. So it's quite rare. But regardless, these were issued under extraordinary circumstances. And the stories of what our country was going through, I think, make for great reading.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I learned quite a bit in looking through this. One of the things that sort of jumped out to me was a fun thing I recall was these notes were originally hand signed. As I recall, Charles Biddle, you have him quoted as saying that he signed as many as 1,800 notes one day, although the average was usually less than that. And I think my hand would cramp up. And the other thing was, you know, people who say, as funny as a $3 bill, well, the U.S. did issue a $3 bill in 1814.
That's right.
So,
in fact, among the survivors of notes from the War of 1812, there is an issued $3 note, which I was able to track down exactly when it was issued and for what reason. And you can find that in the book. And they did issue them during the War of 1812, although they almost issued a $3 note during the Civil War when they began to make the small notes of the legal tender issues in 1862. They came within a month of issuing a $3 to go with the 1 and 2. Didn't do it at the last minute, although there is a proof of that $3 note that exists, but never got issued.
Well, because this volume is an illustrated history, how difficult was it to actually come up with quality illustrations that could go along with this? Because that's, to me, that's a fascination. The words are great, but the pictures, they tell a big story.
Well, thank you. I thought a lot of these notes were tremendously beautifully engraved. Of course, the government wanted to use the highest possible quality engraving for their issues. Because counterfeiting was always a problem. So what you find is really magnificent designs that represent the best of engraving for every era in which they were issued. And especially, of course, in the Civil War, I had to track down, I used every possible source, including collections in the Smithsonian and elsewhere, at private collections. The major auction houses were kind enough to allow me to reproduce them, but just the process of hunting down an individual note was difficult as well. And one of the things I discovered was that issued notes were so heavily used in circulation that it was hard to find a decent one. For example, in the Civil War issues, the typical note, treasury note back then was in well-worn condition, maybe a fine or fine to maybe very fine at best, but you could see just looking at the notes how heavily they had been used, and finding pristine examples was a tremendous challenge. But I thought people who were reading the history would appreciate seeing the actual notes with their own eyes, even if they couldn't own them.
One of the things that I recall vividly was the note that was cut in half. Can you talk about how that came to be, why that was done? And I think that's something that carries over from other paper money as well, right?
Yes. That was back in the War of 1812 era, and one of the difficulties people suffered back then we're talking about an era when the money of the land was coin. But the problem was that sending coin through the mails was very risky. There was a rampant theft. You just did not want to send coins through the mail. During the War of 1812, the government issued treasury notes, and one of the practices back then was to take a note and cut it in half and send the two halves to its destination separately. They could be rejoined when they arrived and then presented for redemption. And this was a case where a fairly well-circulated note from 1815 was discovered, actually just discovered in the last year, cut in half. And that actual note was put on sale on eBay, and a collector bought it. And I had the opportunity to see it firsthand, examine it, and attribute it as to where, whether it was genuine and what era it was from. And put an illustration. That's the first illustration of that note that's been done. But it was very interesting because there were no other large size notes of that kind are known to exist in issued form. So what we have now is at least a half of a note from that era that exists in issued form.
Awesome. Now I want to jump back to the Civil War era. It seems that you discovered there's an interesting story about notes that slipped into Confederate hands. Can you talk about what those notes are and how that happened?
Sure. That was the $50 1861 note. That's a 2-year 6% Treasury note. These were the first notes issued by Secretary of the Treasury Chase after he came into office in March of 1861. Lincoln had appointed him. And he actually thought that ultimately he might be able to pay for the entire Civil War using Treasury notes and not issuing any bonds or any so-called legal tender notes at all. He was opposed to notes decreed legal tender as unconstitutional. So he favored Treasury notes, which were legal. So one of those packets of notes that were being issued by the Treasury Department to troops in the field went to Lieutenant James Brunow in St. Louis. He was stationed in St. Louis, Missouri. He was carrying these packets of notes with him, and he ended up in a huge camp that was put together in, I believe, I want to say Tennessee, by General Grant. And there was a nighttime attack by the Confederates on them, became known as the Battle of Shiloh. It was a huge all-day-long battle where we were driven out of our camps, and the Confederates took over the camps, and they ransacked them for supplies. When Lieutenant Brunow returned to camp, he discovered he had left behind his packet of Treasury notes, and they'd been stolen by the Confederates. He wrote a letter to the Treasury Department, and they actually tracked the serial numbers of those notes for more than 5 years. And they reported in 1869 that a few of them had been presented to the Treasury for redemption, but they were taken as contraband since they were stolen. And because they had tracked these notes, they reported in this annual Treasury report the exact serial numbers that had been issued and who they'd been issued to, which was something that had not been done for any other Treasury notes. And this was, you know, many tens of millions of dollars of Treasury notes had not been done with anyone else. So had a unique window into this issue of these notes. And about half of the outstanding notes that had not been redeemed for the entire issue were those belonging to Lieutenant Brunow, the ones that had been stolen.
Awesome. How cool is that?
It was amazing, amazing find.
So let's wrap things up here real quick. The title of the book hints at this, 1812 to 1865. So War of 1812, Civil War, those are kind of the bookends for the issuance of Treasury notes. What was the reason they shifted away from these, or were there Treasury notes later that you're just not exploring? Or was it, I know that during the war, the federal government got into the business of larger paper money usage. What spelled the end or this transition away, if that is indeed what happened?
Well, in 1863, in the middle of the war, the Treasury Department decided to confer legal tender status on these Treasury notes. And then they issued hundreds of millions of dollars worth to pay the cost of bringing the Civil War to an end. And at that point, once peace was established, the need to issue these notes in massive quantities was over. They just didn't need them. However, collectors will notice that, for example, the issue of legal tender notes of 1869, if you look at the notes, they say right on them, Treasury notes. And that's kind of a source of confusion to a lot of collectors. But generally speaking, the government deemed that, notes that were issued specifically backed by the Treasury Department were called Treasury notes. So they didn't need to issue notes bearing interest anymore to entice the public to use them as money. It took us another more than 20 years or so to get back on a specie standard. So you had many, many years where paper money basically ruled in the United States, and coins could not circulate. So paper money issues continued to dominate for many years after the end of the Civil War.
Awesome. I'm going to let that stand as the last note about treasury notes, no pun intended. I understand Stacks has the book. Is that the best place for folks to get copies?
I think the easiest way is on Amazon. They are for sale on Amazon. If you go to the book section and just enter the title, and you'll find it there.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much for your time today. This has been really fun. Like I say, the book is, you know, it truly is an economic history of early American, and using these fiscal documents, if you will, fiscal items, treasury notes, to shed light on all the various goings on. So thank you so much for being here today and for writing this book.
Well, thank you. I really enjoyed it.
And that was our interview with Nicholas Bruyer, author of the new book about U.S. Treasury notes. I want to say 1812 to 1865 is part of the title. It's a neat book. Really, as I've said in there several times, a nice distillation or presentation of American financial history from, you know, very pivotal moment in the young republic to probably the most pivotal moment in the republic, the end of the through the Civil War and its conclusion. So we learned a lot, and there was so much ground to cover, and I don't even think we scratched the surface, and maybe even we were all over the place. I was all over the place in that interview. We were just, it's just such a fascinating topic, and there's so many things to try to understand and comprehend to it. Hopefully you come away with a better understanding of it, because it's a neat area. And I frankly knew nothing about the topic before picking up the book and speaking with Mr. Bruyer.
And you'll spend hours just looking at the illustrations, because, I mean, they say a picture's worth a thousand words. Well, yeah, definitely these are. And I mean, this is just the accurate depiction of what we're talking about from that time period, and just adds to the intense history that's part of it right there. So very definitely worth picking up. Many, many folks picked it up at the A&A World's Fair of Money as it was available then, but it's still available right now. So I think we mentioned at the end there how you can get that. But, you know, before we started on the interview, and we made sure that we, as we always do, we made sure we had the correct pronunciation of his name. And one of the things I took from that was when he pronounced it, he said it's Bruyer. It's like if you're at a baseball game and you have a brew and you say yay, but I wanted to inject that you're a Cardinals fan, so you wouldn't have that yay part down in 2023. So
yeah, it's been tough this year, and I you know, I was telling folks at the game last night that you know, I went all in and bought all these cheap tickets this year, because they, you know, $6 tickets and $6 cards cash to use at the concessions and all that. And of course, you know, they've turned out to lay a bunch of zeros this year, a bunch of eggs. But it was an enjoyable night at the ballpark, beautiful weather. A friend and I were there and we're chatting and having fun and people watching, and you know, it's a bad day at the ballpark is better than a good day in the office, right? No.
Oh yeah, totally. I mean, that's where you finally were able to get to a single A game here in town, and the home team won 6-2. But it was just great. You may, the only thing about that was knowing that, you know, we're sitting there with some people in their mid-20s and realizing that every player out there in the field is about that same age. So, you know, it's just, I'm long past the day when I watch college football and realize how young these guys are. And now, you know, the pro sports and even, you know, yeah. So it's just beyond the point right there. God love them. They can do that kind of stuff. But it was an entertaining game, 6-2, where play at the plate type thing. the catcher for the opposition team, God love him. He was worked. He was worked hard. The pitcher was wild, and he was stopping everything. I mean, he could have signed up for an NHL team. He was doing a great job back there. You're not supposed to root for the opposition, but you got to root for the athlete. So He did a great job. Hopefully, you know, he can advance through the alphabet and get himself a good position, but he earned his money that night. So that's, well, I think, we've just about wrapped it up here. What do you say?
Yeah. I say, I think it's about time to let everyone get back to their regularly scheduled programming. We thank you. You're still with us for listening this week and every week, and tell your friends, leave a positive review on all the platforms. And if you have questions, comments, complaints, you can always reach us by email. We do this not to hear ourselves talk, but to give you something to listen to. And we thank you for that. So in the meantime,
happy collecting.
Thank you for listening to the Coin World Podcast. Don't forget to subscribe, and we'll see you next week.
Coin World Plus is your new way to collect, manage your inventory, digitally authenticate coins, create your want list, buy and sell coins, and much more. Learn more about Coin World Plus at coinworldplus.com or download the app now at Google Play or the App Store.